this bloated police archive. So I'm suggesting that there's two sides of the archive, which aren't two types of archives, because they're actually very closely related. On the one hand, you have the police archive, this thing I'm saying is bloated and monstrous. And on the other hand, other kinds of archives, more cultural repositories. And while the police archive insists on status and standardised, quantifiable information, and it harnesses more and more complex techniques to pursue this aim, other archives seem to be starting to acknowledge or even embrace things like mobility, uncertainty, decay, unreliability. So just to end then, the psychoanalytic analogy would be with the working of memory in the unconscious, which is kind of old hat, you know, this is used by Derrida and other writers, that the idea that the archive is connected to, it can be analogous to the human mind in a Freudian way. But if you think about the police archive in terms of total recall, aiming at total recall, aiming at the absolute register of citizens, you know, then the other side of that might be to accept that what an archive can be for art or for culture and for history is a bit like what the day's residues can be for a dream in a kind of Freudian narrative. That is that the archive contains perhaps the stuff of culture that didn't enter consciousness, wasn't entirely accounted for the first time round. But maybe it was too traumatic or too insignificant to properly register. So I was thinking of the Milgram experiment, for instance, is interesting because it's both traumatic and extremely banal. It's that strange combination of the everyday and the incredibly difficult to deal with traumatic aspect of culture. So this stuff lingers, like unprocessed, unconscious material in the Freudian model of the mind, ready to be returned to and shuffled into new kind of surprising constellations, just as the dream reworks the leftovers of the day, according to Freud. So if you continue that Freudian analogy, if dream interpretation was this thing that could open the path to the unconscious and to all that stuff that had been repressed, but which the dreamer was compelled to repeat, precisely because it was too traumatic or too unprocessed to deal with in any other way. And this is just a suggestion, just a provocation, just a suggestion. So the reuses and recreations made with archival material might open up new paths into repressed, disavowed or undealt with aspects of culture. So it's trying to imagine a different way, perhaps, of thinking about the archive that sets a stronger polarity, if you like, between the police archive and the cultural repository archetype. Okay, so that was just to kind of sum up maybe some of the ways that we've been kind of trying to piece together bits of discussions that we've had over the past 4 weeks, but I'd like to open it up now and just see where you thought we might have arrived at, or what ideas have remained with you from the workshops, what things you think are worth developing and taking forwards. Whether you feel, for example, that we've simply kind of gone over, those of you who are well-read on archive theory, and so whether we've just gone over the same ground, or whether there are new, interesting things coming up that are worth exploring further. Long pause.
Well, I wouldn't hear too long.
Well, obviously for me, what you're saying about the cultural archive and ways of reopening up and access to past at the time, it can be too traumatic at the time, but can be revisited in different lines. It's obviously very relevant to the materials I've been working with. The Pitt Rivers Museum have put up some materials that they have from the Sudan online in a very informational database style, but the demand for those materials from the Sudanese diaspora is absolutely massive, because there is no history of that time recorded by those people themselves, because it was the time when they just weren't using materials we've been using for 150 years, so there is a demand for those materials. Okay, they were taken by anthropologists in the whole colonial context, but those materials can be reinterpreted and reused in a different context for different purposes.
How do you think your more kind of artistic, more creative in some ways, reworking of that material is going to be. How does that affect with their, how does that relate to the uses they might make?
Big question. I'm grappling with trying to find some ways where the authored materials, user generated materials, can fit together somehow or can be useful to each other. And someone was suggesting that you could have some kind of thing where you could move between first person, third person, second person perspectives. Interface that would then to move between those into example. I don't know. We have some answers, really. That's part of the research, I suppose. But maybe come together in unexpected and surprising ways. Don't know about it. That's the nut to crack.
Can I ask you any question? Just wondering how the series of seminars have informed the strategy that's going on in Finland, and how you're approaching it. And I'm implicated in that question, but just wondering whether it's changed your way of approaching it in the last 3 months.
Yeah, I guess when I kept coming to the job, my first job was after this, and having not come to what was all their training as an artist, but somebody knows it better than feeling prior to coming to it without too much baggage. Well, I have come to that, like, I'm trying to keep that in mind. I guess for me, it's like a massive unrealised potential that requires traditional archiving processes, stages to go through in order that the material can be opened up. Once it's opened up, it's quite exciting to kind of hear about, especially hearing from the artists, about the ways in which they kind of use that material to kind of do other projects. We were just looking at Richard Wilson's file, and there's a whole place, and the whole thing didn't happen. There's quite a few of those. You're imagining for, I'll say, our 50th anniversary, going through the archives and building all those projects that with all those records as well. So it's that kind of.
So
it's more for me, it's potential for doing things in the future rather than as some sort of nostalgic record of our past that excites me.
The themes you've been working through, they represent the potential of the projects as well. Maybe so.
It has to be, somebody said it today, as in order for an archive, and it's hardly said it, that in order for the kind of preservation, conservation, and access issue, one is kind of dependent on the archives have to be used in order to preserve it. What we use is band up with our preservation. There's no point in just preserving
it. Just to comment on something you've just said, Julian, I think that is a shift in thinking, and perhaps in your thinking, I don't know, but in a way the statement you've just made, you've just gone from suggesting that the material needs to be conserved in order that it can then be made accessible for use.
Yeah.
Whereas actually maybe a shift to make is that it's through the use or the preparation for exhibition that it might also be conserved, and that those are ongoing processes that happen in parallel rather than one needing to be completed, which of course will never be completed in advance of the other process beginning.
Yeah, I mean that's certainly.
I mean that's me being pragmatic.
Yeah, certainly the position I find myself in working with you and others is that is definitely in front of views and explore the archive as go through that consortium building process. So it's not just something we've done in isolation. And this, the series is also a project.
What are you currently spending your time doing? I'm just wondering what the kind of plan or there is, or
sort of
evolving strategy.
Yeah, it's still evolving, but there's two archives, there's also the work in the research projects. One is to finish the kind of sorting which they're doing. And with this fortune set, so it's really developing.
So what do you have now? A lot of sheets?
No, I haven't. Yeah, boxing. I've already weeded materials, the same in duplications of material and rubbish units. And put together the important stuff to keep cattle. So that's one part. That's part of the other thing is trying to think of strategies for the organisation. Well, so that things can happen again, but we can kind of know what's on the hard work. So that was the hard work, points of creation. I'm trying to think that through both the physical materials as well as traditional materials. So we don't have that situation.
And you mean perhaps you mean events as they're happening now?
Yeah, the first thing to do is trying to get the structures to out of what which documents get out of documentation that's produced here, that has to get produced, which ones do you want to change the thing? Which ones you want to use?
So you're promoting you to the ones that you want.
I'm thinking about ways of collecting
them. Can I?
Like that. It's more interesting in the fact that it's unrealised, and it's interesting how things change in their currencies and move along with time. And so, we've been going through these archives and these things that Reggie's worked at for 25 years, and suddenly it's kind of interesting. And you get, like, artists writing is unpublished, and it becomes of interest because it was never published, but you can see the mix that maybe can be read into some sort of pieces of work now. Maybe for Rich Wilson, it's more interesting to hear something that you never actually did achieve at the time, but the things we know about that inspired the proposal maybe shifted him in a different direction that you can see in the middle of that. There's an anecdote about Picasso I read the other day, about how there's a guy who goes to an art dealer in Paris during Picasso's lifetime and tries to second-hand sell a Picasso painting, and the dealer accuses him of being a forgery, and so that's very upsetting. And swears on his life that he bought the painting directly from an artist. The guy still wanted to do them, so the guy goes back to Picasso and says, "Will you authenticate that this work for me, please, because I'd like to sell it." Gets the chance of passing this on and says that he won't do this, and the guy says, "But I bought this direct a few years ago," and Picasso replies, "Yes, but you can hardly point to fit Picasso." It's the idea that he's moved on and it's not interesting to him in the way he thinks it was by catalogue. It's another thinking about recently, about human conversation. And we're talking about the way that conceive archives is until we've been held over in that static and limited and changing. As an artist, we kept going back to the paintings, and even after they've been printed in books and kind of changing them because he wasn't happy. So is that thing within paintings, they have to go back and kind of that sort of thing. So where's the original, where's the that fluidity can still be present in the world.
Oh no, I think it's a very strange thing that happens when the art taken, it gets taken from your hands and by an institution or something, by a collector or whatever. Things that were designed to be, you know, easily reproducible and basically disposable suddenly become very precious, and other things that seemingly over time were somehow very precious or somehow sort of evade the documentation process. So kinds of very strange things like that, in my experience.
When you're talking about
physics,
the chemical
It's happened to me in the past, but it's happened to me recently too, the Grinch biscuits are made to basically be shipped very easily in a couple of boxes with documents, and then gallery installation is very simply built. But now that's in the collection, they want the whole thing, they want all the things that are supposed to be disposable. It's very strange, it's a very strange situation to be in.
It's part of the archiving of your work, isn't it? When anything becomes important, isn't it? It's going to put that in there. That's now been elevated to an icon, it has an importance because it came out of that folder. It's the same as, when you liked it or something.
Yeah. But I think it changes the nature of the work, actually. Because the nature of the work is that it's kind of, there's a sort of element to it which is about the instruction to do something. And then there's a sort of, there's another, so by fixing that thing they sort of change that sort of instructional nature. And also, that piece in particular, actually, the other thing I'm kind of grappling with at the moment is, of course, the newspapers are going to get old.
Go back every year and get a new one.
Well, yeah, that's exactly what's going to happen, I think. Yeah.
Is that... I wasn't here for that session, but I'm assuming that Stephen spoke about the media art notation system and other approaches to collecting.
Yeah.
I was just thinking that, in a way... this system that, I don't know if you've heard about it, but that Frank Linfernis and the Guggenheim were working on with Berkeley Art Museum and a guy called Richard Reinhardt there. But they were, in a way, they've been coming up with a way of interviewing artists. I suppose it's largely come out of how to collect and how to conserve digital artworks or works that are transient in some form, and in a way, I think it's also useful for works. I don't know, for example, that use TV monitors or something that's going to become obsolete in the near future. Are we going to, in a way, interviewing the artist and, for example, asking kind of what's asking what the limits of the artwork are, and whether, for example, the particular form of display, for example, on a television rather than a flat screen monitor, whether that's essential to the work remaining the same work. And in a way, that seems a much more productive way potentially to think about collecting such works, because in a way it seems like you've already predetermined that actually in a way you could determine certain kind of rules for the reinstallation of that work around kind of the necessity to reprint the papers so that they haven't aged and it sounds like you've already kind of determined that the particularity of the light fitting or the particularity of the kind of display furniture is not essential to that work being the same work. And that seems like a more productive way, potentially, of collecting. I wonder how much power you have to determine what's within the work and what isn't.
Well, that's the thing I was trying to drive at, actually, was that as an artist, actually, that power is limited as well, actually. And then once the work leaves your possession, then actually you don't really have any recourse back to it.
But thinking about the web 2 thing and the Frank Furness is something sort of imagine Jeff likes to do on themes, that the archive is left open to change your mind about that artwork in the same way that the painter would have potential to say, you know, that TV monitor that I thought then was absolutely essential. Just, you know, you could leave that information, you could just edit that into the documentation, edit it into the artwork, if that's the way it's been intended.
It's essential that it's not an energy saving light bulb.
I guess I'll do that. I mean, I'm not sure what, I mean, I'm not sure in a way, I think you're trying to find a solution to something that in a way what I'm trying to flag up is just the you know, the archiving process itself is about, is essentially, is going to be about fixing things in some way or another.
Yeah.
I think. Whether it's via an interview or whatever it is, you know, fix an opinion or whatever. But whereas obviously that's, you know, not necessarily the nature of a practice.
But couldn't you also see it as, because the hesitation I have with the system you're describing and the driving force behind it in a way is perhaps too much respect accorded to the artist. I think arts institutions and art and I think that I'm saying this as someone who practices an artist himself, not as someone who's dissing an artist, but as an author as well. You know, you make something, it goes out into the world. You have children, they grow up. You know, these things happen. They go out and they do their own stuff. And there is a sense in which any cultural producer has to come to terms with the fact that you let go, and I think most people do know that, and that's part of the pleasure of making stuff, is going, you're out now, you're off on your own, do what you will.
But
those contexts will change, and it will move and change.
But there's still what you can define as the text. I mean, not all work is like that, but work that has clearly defined boundaries as a text. Because I'm just thinking of the writers who said on my deathbed, I wish my, it's completely escaping them. Really famous poet wrote the Fuck Luck, Mum, Dad. Larkin, you know, there was this whole debate about when he died. He said, I want all my letters and things to be burned because I want to be remembered for my work, not for everybody writing about my personal relationships or, you know, I don't want that to shape the way people look at the work. But the work is the poems, and that needs to be respected as the work. And this obsession now with context. And with artists who kind of completely work into a gallery and then it's no longer yours. It's just quite interesting. Maybe that's the culture that we're in now. You know, some artists probably never imagined or dreamed that people would be so interested in all the other stuff.
But it may not be about, I don't think it's about text. It doesn't have to be about text versus context. It can also be about at what point does the artist or whoever produces, let's say, notion for the text.
Well, I think
how it should live its life out.
I think the difference, though, is what we're talking about now is that whenever we're talking about artwork that exists in an immediate form, you know, by the very nature of that form, it's variable and not fixed.
Yeah.
I mean, the painting example is quite exceptional. The example of the guy repainting things, despite the fact they've been published in the book. It's quite an unusual, of course. It shows the possibilities, but it's quite exceptional. Whereas that's the norm, actually, for a media-based practice.
Yeah, where you go back and might re-edit.
Well, not even that, but just the way in which it's presented is going to essentially like a re-edit itself. So
you might find, for instance, you might find it fascinating or even quite funny that someone should perceive a table or something as an essential part of the work that you just saw as a table to put the work on, for example. But then you might accept that that's kind of funny or ridiculous, but also accept that that's what's going to happen. That's what happens when stuff goes out there. That's what happens. You know. Whereas if we constantly have to keep judging it against artists' intentions, then we return to a kind of pre-death of the author situation where authorial intention is so heavily privileged. I don't know.
It's not about kind of being, you know, a sort of strange reason thing. It's more what Paul was saying, actually, that it just fundamentally changes the work, actually. If the work is just in a state that is variable, and yet it was exhibited in a way that where that variability was, at least for a moment in time, fixed, then once that leaves the control of that circumstance, whoever it is that controls it, and it then becomes essentially variable again, because that's its nature, then it can be represented in a way that is really completely unrepresentative of, you know, its original circumstance. I mean, that's just a general problem of media art.
I suppose I'm recognising the same problem, I'm just saying, do you fight it?
I don't think it's about authorial intention. It's just a sort of, you know, it's just about, I mean actually, you know, in terms of just on a practical base, you know, dealing with contemporary art centres and museums and things, actually, of course, for them, the variability of work is very convenient, because it means that they can sort of, you know, we'll try and lever it into any kind of situation that is convenient for them very often. And if you talk to any media artists, they'll tell you that it's, you know, obviously vitally important with that kind of variability, that you fix it.
Life.
Yeah, absolutely, because curators will otherwise see it as fair game to do whatever they want with.
Mm. In a way, it's thinking of... In a way, it's kind of thinking about what Julia's mentioning also, in terms of having, you know, the archivist as collaborator at the point of the work's creation, rather than coming to the work some way down the line, and thinking about how you can work with an artist as a collaborator around how the work would be remade, reinstalled in future, thinking towards kind of future contexts, and in a way learning from variable media art that inevitably needs to be emulated. And in a way, the difference isn't so great. How is installation art, how will installation art be emulated in future? I mean, you raise an interesting instance with, for example, the inevitable kind of decay and deterioration of the kind of paper-based of the newspapers. In a way, the work will be more different in future, if we are in its, the encounter will with the work by the public in future will be more different if we attempt to conserve the original documents than it would be if we followed your instructions as an artist about the reproduction, you know, of different documents. So it's looking towards future emulation, whether it's kind of digital media work or not.
Is that why you're saying that it's media art and performance kind of a lot in common in terms of the temporality? Is that what you meant?
I meant lots of different things, but I think
one of the things.
I wasn't really thinking about archiving, actually. Just
an interesting thing about the Marina Abramovich piece, where she seems to take some pieces that she wants to interpret. Chris Bateman told her that she couldn't do one of those pieces. It's kind of quite interesting when you look at that. And so she, although it seems to kind of be reluctant in her role, is this sort of kind of respectful in the relationship with the original source material?
I was going back to all the friends who are in the theatre, who adapt books and want to base this theatre on a book, have to seek permission from the writer, if the writer's absolutely no, then if that piece then kind of refers to that book in any way, then they could be, you know, in trouble. So it's funny how writers seem to have much more respect and much more sense of control than artists.
Isn't that also to do with that writing has been around with us a long time, and there's been a whole legal, if you like, legal framework built up.
Yeah.
I mean, the whole basis of copyright law and things like that all centre around the written text, and even obscenity law, all that kind of stuff. It's all it's bizarre. It's been the written text.
Yeah, we haven't even discussed the legal implications of working on an archive. Because the archive is always owned by people.
Yeah.
contract laws changed.
I mean, I think there's a lot of that with art. We might, like you're saying about artists maybe not being within this kind of legal framework. I think a lot of that is generally because when you work with artists and artists work with other artists, there's a kind of unwritten sort of rule, I think, really. It's quite, in the end, everything's quite small communities. So you don't tend to, unless you deliberately want to piss them off, which obviously does happen, but I guess with this whole archive thing, we're just stepping into the legalities of it, especially with digitising archives and the type of usage and exposure that they're going to have. I think it's still very muddy. I think the waters are quite muddy about what it is that you have to seek yourselves and what you can leave to be retrospectively sort of come to, I suppose. I think a lot of people still think that any exposure is okay, you know, it depends. Then how it's used, I suppose.
Just on the radical end of this kind of archiving, something like Pirate Bay.
Yeah, I mean.
What did you say?
Yeah.
Pirate Bay?
Yeah. Pirate Bay, yeah. This is supposed to be my interest in the way that these kind of activities have collected and distributed things and reusing them, what that kind of says about culture more broadly. You know, so, Pirate Bay seems a really good example, you know, where intellectual property is.
What
is it? It's a BitTorrent repository.
What was the outcome of the court case?
Pardon?
What was the outcome of the court case?
The most recent one, I think.
They were in court, I think, only last week.
They're interested to take them to court.
The court case is still ongoing.
Okay.
There's an interesting article on the Red in the Register, if you know that online paper, because it turns out one of the major owners of the of Pirate Bay, they happens to be a leading right-wing neo-Nazi.
Well, that's getting interesting.
It's fundamental. It's fundamental, isn't it? It's a discussion. It's come up a little bit all across the seminars.
Yeah. I mean, something. I mean, I've worked with a lawyer in many cases, and I've worked with Melbourne because I knew although the archive is owned by Yale University, I think I'm not exactly quite sure how it works, but the ownership is definitely shared with Milgram Widow, Alexandra Milgram. And I knew from previous cases that she's very litigious. And so I was pretty aware that if I was going to do this thing, that there'd be a legal action against me, unless it was negotiated. I wish she found out. And I thought it was fairly likely she would find out, unless it was negotiated. So I worked with a copyright lawyer to figure out at what point, if and how and when we were going to breach copyright, and then to try and kind of construct a legal case for that breach. And it was very interesting, actually, the breach of copyright actually only happened when I photocopied the transcripts, the scripts. So the bizarre thing about copyright in this law, in this country, not America, but in this country, is that you can have someone read the transcripts and film them. You then own I don't own the film of a person reading the transcript. As long as the transcript hasn't been reproduced, it's no breach of copyright. So there are sort of bizarre. I think as an artist, that's part of your job to figure all that stuff out.
Or to
willfully ignore it.
Yeah.
You know, whichever. Yeah.
That's one of the things when we talked about this at the legal side, and just kind of touched on it. Mm-hmm. We talked briefly at the end of the last workshop about how archives were so closely connected to the governments and it's tied to that notion of elite knowledge and so on, but in their origins. But the other thing I think that you're bringing up there is that when you're not talking necessarily about arts archives, where it's clear it's probably the artist you need to speak to or the estate. But other kinds of archives, like things like World Memorial, copyright can be quite complicated, and in some cases can be held by a person who bears no relation to the person who is being archived. So personal archives can be held and owned by people who founded the archive. and you have to seek permission. And then things like, just things that academics take for granted, for example, you can quote a certain amount of text and copy it without worrying about copyright, a certain number of words before it becomes, before you're plagiarising or lifting. Or even before you have to ask permission. With an archive, it's not like that, is it? You can do a few, can have some, they can settle their own rules in fact, it seems to me. Well, certainly the ones I've researched, where some of them will say you're free to use anything, others will say if you've got a sentence from this, you need to write a letter to this guy if you ask permission. So this, it seems quite a hazy kind of idiosyncratic.
Mm-hmm. So my understanding is also that isn't there a difference also whether somebody gives a collection as a donation to the archive, in which case the archive owns the material and can get the archive is there, or whether the archive actually remains within the possession of the private person and the archive is just just holds it.
You mean a difference between a loan and a deposit, don't you?
Yes, so
there is
deposit,
a difference.
You know, you wouldn't have to easily contact the archive, but if it's a loan, you'll have to always go back to the original.
And we've steered away from loans now as much as we possibly can, because they're just an absolute nightmare, because effectively it means that whoever the artist or practitioner will ever come and say they'll want it back, or no, you take these, you know, they have a lot of control over it. Bristol or Vic is a classic one, that's one of our big ones on there, and London or Vic.
Do you think they're just giving it to you because they don't want to look after it themselves?
I think there's an awful lot of that, actually. There is an awful lot of that. But I mean, that's okay, because we look after it, we make it accessible, and that's the whole point of it.
Yeah,
you know, so
yeah.
It's fine.
So, I mean, certain
but it doesn't,
sure.
You know, we're sort of like doing all the work for, you know, because it's a risk, so you know, most of ours aren't. And we also, the other one we have on loan is Joyce Grenfell's archive, and that copyright-wise is a nightmare because there's 6 different people involved in her estate, so if somebody wants to reproduce anything or perform it at a wedding or, you know, something like that, they have to go. It's a really, really complicated one, so we try and put them off as much as possible, because it's just, well, they move, they get put off anyway, because they just think when you say you've got to go and contact these 6 people, they just want to perform a little poem, they don't go for it, so it's a bit of a nightmare.
I was just wondering, I think you've got about half an hour left, and I was just thinking, when I started, going to kind of approach Julie about kind of applying for the grant to do this, and so it's because I had a kind of interest in collaborating on work collection, but also had an interest in archives coming from my own work in cultural studies and museums and arts and stuff. And you know how sometimes you just get a sense that something's happening, something's interesting is happening with something that hadn't seemed interesting before, perhaps. And that was my feeling, that the archives suddenly seemed interesting to me, because they seemed to face sort of problems. I mean, probably to archivists, they've always been interesting, you know, they might not seem to have changed, but it suddenly seemed to be something that have become vivid to me or problematic or interesting. And is it just me, or do you think that we are at a certain moment where there's, if you like, if, you know, that was what I was trying to raise when I was talking about, where archives are kind of, I don't know, symptomatic of something larger or undergoing a dramatic change, you know? Is it just that theorists and writers have become interested in archives so they can find books, or is it just because I'm looking at archive books or something?
There's been a movement for institutions to have archives, and the other thing is a real place for that.
A proliferation of archives that's happening?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, because of the digitisation process that people are now kind of suddenly going, oh shit, yeah, we're going to do that, or we're going to start it. Because there are certain elements within their storeroom with staff that needs to be dealt with, I suppose. And they see that there's a need to deal with that material, just simply to preserve it, I think.
What's so interesting is coming from Germany, there's been a long interest really in archives. And if you look at artist practices, there's, of course, in societies like Germany or Russia, for example, quite a long engagement with archives. Look at the work of Kabakov, or something. I mean, it's all about archives. And it, of course, it's tied in with the police archive, with the presence of totalitarianism and so on. And so I organized an event at the British Museum in 2001, and a friend of mine who's also German, and we called it Dialogues on Archiving, and we invited various people, and Michael Lundy was there, he had just done his big Oxford Street breakdown project and stuff. And we, in the run-up to this, we talked to a lot of people about archives, and it was, I'm not kind of claiming that we were there first, but it's really interesting how, at that point, that wasn't really the debate people were interested in. It was just at the cusp when, in the UK, this was becoming of interest to people. We actually had lots of conversations with people who said to me, what do you mean? What do you Germans mean by archives? We talk about documentation, we don't talk about archives, particularly within the context of performance. Archives as a concept wasn't really talked about at all. And it has been of interest to me, why it is that there is this kind of archive fever to stay on within, particularly within artist practice and also scholarship within the UK, particularly in these past few years. Because I think there are just differences.
So you've been wondering about this, but what do you think is the interest?
I think there are more commissions around artists working with archives that I've noticed since I've been involved with art practice. You know, there's some very definite, quite large commissions now, like the one where it was everyday people writing down.
Mass observation.
That's the one, yeah. Mm-hmm. So things like that, with people working and using archives, it seems more recently. I don't know whether that's just because I've become involved in archive stuff that I'm now more aware of, it's not just through art practice, but through
other elements. That's interesting that you've mentioned mass observation, because I would say that was the other moment, that was the moment of the Universal Survey movement of Britain. So you had mass observation, but you had various others who had kind of forgotten the survey movement. So it's certainly this kind of, so the play, the plays, and but it was in the 1940s. And 30s, throughout the 30s and 40s, so there was a big kind of drive at that moment to do surveys, statistics, to kind of capture everyday life in Britain, not just mass observation, but others too. So I'm not just thinking about these as intellectual fashions, but I'm curious, like say, how it connects with a larger of what's going on, rather than just its digitisation.
It does seem to bring back to police work, doesn't it? And the kind of self-archiving that everyone's engaged in. Using digital systems.
I talked from an artist's point of view. I don't think there's also considerable, not in terms of, I can't really comment on why it's so popular in artistic fields at the moment, but over the last 10, 15 years, the archive sector itself has put a lot of work into raising the profile, a lot of work that perhaps the general population may not be aware of. But no one talked about archives really. It was the realm of academics, particularly historians, and people just didn't know what potential there was there.
Perhaps it's also got a lot to do with genealogy as well, people seeking to find their own sort of historical.
But I think also that, the last 10 years, genealogy has been really popular, and I think people are getting a bit bored of it. I'm thinking, okay, well, we all know you can use archives for family history, but what else can you use it for? What's more inventive, what's more creative?
Why do you think the archive sector is important? Why do you think that it has raised its problem? Is it connected to?
Just probably a lot to do with funding. Is it connected? because they really were being run into the ground. The staff at local record offices and public record offices were shrinking because people weren't using the service that they offered. So I think it was a genuine, conscious outreach. And people just opened their eyes to the fact that you could use archives in education. It wasn't that popular 20 years ago to actually use archives in education. I think it's because people have been reaching out looking for justifying their existence and funding, trying to prove that they deserve it. And as a result, in the last 10 years, there's been a huge boom, new archive buildings going up, projects being funded by Heritage Lottery Fund, other forms of art funding, so there's a lot to do with money, but I think there's a lot of passion behind it from artists and people who work in that sector as well. It's always been seen as the little brother to museums. The museums get the the big headlines and the big buildings and have massive education programs. Farmers have to work really hard over the last 10 to 20 years to actually get on to some kind of like a legal footing.
It's interesting that there seems to be an increased self-reflexivity about this also about their practices, because that was also something I remember from that initial those dialogues that we curated. We wanted to find an archivist who was prepared to talk about what it is that they do, and we just talk about the decisions that they make and how they go about what they do. We could not find a single archivist. So actually the person who invited them was the mass exhibition archivist, Dorothy Sheridan, who's actually not a trained archivist. We talked about the mass observation archive, but we couldn't find this classic archivist who was prepared to talk about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the traditional archivists, and by traditional I'm talking about in the 1960s, they're very insular. They were very focused on cataloguing work and intellectually understanding their collections rather than actually explaining them to other people. And it's not like you said, really not trying to tell them how to interpret it, but actually to explain to them how they process archives, and therefore saying, now this is up to you to do something with it. We're very internalised at doing it. I mean, that's Julian and I were saying earlier how it's now you see programmes like YouTube, and there are archivists on TV who are actually talking about the things that they care about.
It's a bit like a time
table. And archivists on TV who aren't equal. Thank you, the modern role of the archivist in since antiquity has been portrayed as
I think there was also a definite tendency to the whole knowledge is power thing, to hold on to what they invest and be the experts in and not necessarily want to talk to other people about it. And now that's a popular thing. People want to share it and want to pass that information on and that knowledge on. Social
shift. Yeah, Terry Cook makes that point, the archive theorist, that of course as soon as you focus your attention on the way an archivist does things, then of course the whole investment in knowledge and the sort of truth value of knowledge starts being shaken out. And a lot of our investments into seeing archive practices as something that is kind of comes natural and self-evident isn't being questioned has to do with the fact that of course our whole this historical knowledge is based upon that. We have to have that investment. We have to believe that nobody's really tampered with those documents, that everything is self-evident in order for us to make those kinds of claims. As soon as you say, okay, actually archivists are doing something and they're changing it by doing it, then of course it's an important question.
I think there's also an element of, again, just guessing, but I think there's an element of 21st century-ness about it, or, that idea that the First World War now, that generation, are gone, practically, I don't know how many people are standing at the cenotaph, one or two, is it? That the two major wars of the 20th century, the two major historical ruptures, if you like, are becoming, have become historical events because they're piling past those generations now. So there's, like, you look at the BBC's kind of archive, because we look at all history type things, all the BBC websites, so there is a kind of popular kind of movement to gather the old history of those generations and things. So I think that's a kind of, just been a kind of recent focus on.
Well, isn't there a kind of understanding that our recent history actually has material worth as well? I mean, that there's a certain movement in general sort of behaviour, like you have the Antiques Roadshow for stuff from the 1960s or whatever. There's kind of understanding that you should hold on to things a lot more than maybe we had. That idea of maybe in the 80s, where it was disposable,
against the modernism.
Well, yeah, and also just people keeping collections of certain things, I think, is much more prevalent in some generalness. Whether it's, you would call it a collection or an archive or whatever, I think it's just that certain interest in
in general.
There's a kind of relativity to it as well, but particularly in arts, some degree of practice, say 50, 60, 70 rejected objects, and now they're trying to find their kinds in their place in the art world, and it's through their archives that they're coming into existence. And you take rapidly buying up archives left, right, and centre to fill this enormous hole, because there's no object-based substance by which to associate this thing. The archives are coming to Australia, which the other thing is. That's another reason why people are buying archives. There's been, they have financial worth. It's become a major issue. Why? Victoria works for Richard Deakin now, don't you? Richard Deakin employs a private office.
Lots of it's a university archives, especially in the library's archives.
His state of unfairness, that's an interesting statement in itself. And suddenly become, as opposed to being a family collection, it's suddenly become.
Yes, someone has to, probably from his family, has now got to administer that, which they, you know, so you see the trust upon them to go swiftly, which is, it's quite odd.
So what I was saying about maybe a drive to popular historical or this being archival connected to the war, I'm just trying to get it so much. You could also see this in the art world to being connected with the 16th and
17th
century, towards life art forms and tangible forms of culture.
There is this, in fact, there's back things that we should touch on, and there are gaps in terms of collecting. And that's something that's come out with the development work for the new museum in Bristol, that the contemporary collection hasn't maybe been all that it should have been in the museum circles, and they're looking to the archives to fill those gaps with the information they need. But, you know, oral history, I think a factor in terms of its popularity has been that it's looking back at what we would have liked to have known about previous periods that we didn't get from the voice of the people that were actually alive at the time. So there's some sort of preparation for the future in that point of view as well. And it's like how can we say that some of the memories were actually prompted by how you didn't do it. So it's the same sort of thing, you're being spurred on by how you don't want things to happen, they weren't done in the past.
I mean, I'm really fascinated by the burden of the archive, or by the ambiguity of the gift of the archive, because I'm meeting so many widows and children of artists through my research who are lumbered with this stuff, and they feel that sense of responsibility, and they sit in houses that are stuffed full to the brim with the remains of their husbands or fathers, and they recognize that there's some kind of worth and value, but they don't know what that is. And that kind of responsibility is becoming increasingly interesting to me, how people start to negotiate that.
That's it, it's just the end of the novel, isn't it? To make it new and let go of the past and this future, as well as the sense of anxiety to hold on to the past. It provides status all the time.
But archives are emerging for institutions as well, aren't they?
Yes.
I know that Reading University, that the archive I was researching, it takes their time. You know, the success of the archives, but it's become very successful, it's become popular again. But it takes an awful lot of their time, and people who let them go to lectures and things like that, who happen to be there to let them in, and so on. So, and they are, they're not well funded, you know, these things necessarily. And often the university circles, there isn't an archivist. Most of the time, so their success can sometimes threaten the. And the person who founded them sometimes seems to be like an academic or someone who's writing a PhD on a particular subject, and it's so interesting that they need to get a relation before you open an
archive.
And then that person retires and leaves, and the stuff is still there. And it's become historically valuable.
You're going to do your own.
I'm going to pass it on to future generations.
It's rather bad, isn't it? It's burning for an archive. It's stated.
So, what archive do you, as your work is in It's in collections, isn't it?
It's in collections. I think the problem with being an artist is just the same as this common conversation with the artist, like just the endless process of, you know, archiving things. And also shifting the media as well, constantly. You know, to go back to that.
And why do you need to do that? Because that's what you need to do, you need to do as well, that's what you're expected to do.
Yeah, you can't say something slow.
So that's a long time since the slide comes on. But can you just say we did it? It's just that's it. That's all I'd be able to do is the whole stuff. Have a digital image. The slide's great.
Yeah, but the work, but the work is pre-based that way. You didn't document it in that way.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because in a way, there are many artists, particularly artists who make kind of transient or ephemeral work, are growing older right now and are now concerned about their legacy, really.
Yeah.
Despite the fact that they probably set out to make ephemeral work precisely to resist the possibility of it being collected and to resist its commodification and kind of exchange within the art market. And at the same time, just as artists are kind of working closely with archivists and embracing archive, actually, the archival impulse within visual art, it seems to me, kind of actually a desire to critique archiving and archives as a place of power and where state knowledge resides. And you know, if you think about people like the Atlas Group, in a way, work with the archive becomes a way of engaging with the fiction of documentary evidence and the constructiveness of archives and how archives might be constructed to hold particular state knowledge and to produce particular versions of histories. And archives have become a way, really, of engaging with the constructiveness of history and the fiction of documentary reality. And it's, in a way, a lot of artists' engagements with archives are critical.
But critique is often ambivalent, isn't it? In a sense, you know, that old thing about the thing you satirise or parody, you invoke, you pay homage to it at the same time through referencing it, you raise it up. You think there's always that ambivalence about any artistic critiques that you're engaging with it. So,
in a cultural context, I'm thinking of Fukuyama, who wrote about the end of history, and you've got the neoliberal kind of drive towards everyone who won the ideological war, and everybody is naturally going to turn to that kind of way. That's been with us, hopefully it's been beyond that, but we've had that with us for quite a while. And in a cultural, ideological context, there's been a drive to kind of create archives, create histories different cultures in different ways, fear that they'll be forgotten in this kind of drive towards modern cultures and the natural way that everybody wants to be. Does that make sense? But in terms of this archival imperative that I mentioned before, I've worked with Tibetans and they have been manically recording and creating an archive just in order to have status in exile in India. Without that archive, without that sense of history, it's hard to have power or status as a cultural group, to articulate yourself as a cultural group, to have status and to get access to funding. That becomes an imperative.
And the potentiality of the archive is precisely in the kinds of projects that kind of Rog showed this morning in terms of the doctoring of those images. There's the potential in the collection of different voices, different materials, different representations within the archive, between those, there's much potential for the writing of different histories and the telling of different stories, and stories of, and more marginal stories potentially, rather than the singular authorised history that we might have turned to in historical writing previously. So perhaps there's a shift from looking at authorised histories towards looking at the archive as a more fragmentary set of records around particular events.
But in cultural theory, it's an old story, isn't it? Back to Foucault, not least, but isn't an old story that archives are? About relations and about objects, all this kind of stuff. I'm not really sure that we're thinking about them in any irrelevant ways here and now than that kind of writing at that point in time at all.
I suppose it takes a while. It takes a while, doesn't it, for those kinds of ideas to filter both into kind of arts practices potentially, and also certainly into kind of popular culture.
Arts practices usually pretty slow.
Yeah. So maybe.
Just to be contentious.
I know this is about collections, not some chapters, but I always think about Jimmy Durham and he was asked to, when the National Museum of American Indian in the United States said that it was this colonial institution, if you like. They were trying to kind of, when they moved, before they moved it to Washington, and while it was moved to Washington, they tried to kind of reinvent it and to bring in other voices and other recordings of different people from different American Indian nations speaking about their cultures and so on. But, so they were trying to open up to different voices, and then they decided for the new museum in Washington that they were going to consult heavily with the community in terms of stakeholders. And Jim Durham said, because it's the Smithsonian, basically, that they had thousands of moccasins, and they were saying, it was basically like, do you want this stuff back? And you say, what would we do? Well, what do you expect us to do with millions or thousands of moccasins? The Smithsonian's the best place for all of them. So in a sense, it was this, like, when it comes, when you come face to face with this kind of museum culture, somewhere like this ridiculous large scale collections, Native Americans would have never kept that many moccasins. For what purpose would they? It's only a Western museum culture that would have done such. And so that idea of bringing in other voices and so the same with the archive, in a sense the archive is a product of this culture. And how much you bring in those other voices or try to challenge and kind of its connection with governments and so on. In the end it's a product, of that. And what else would you do with it? So he said, keep them obviously. We don't really need them, thanks. So it's very odd. But I suppose his strategy in a way is to make you look at Western culture as important, and to reverse the anthropological gaze and make you look at Western culture as a peculiar habits of keeping and reacting. I don't know. I suppose when you think about the workshops, I don't think it matters if we have a new field.
We're in a plenary department, so we're trying to assess what we've got to as a consequence of all these hours and hours of talking and presentation. I don't know if everyone comes to these issues from their own mindset. I still find it difficult to separate the issues around databases and databases being a kind of cultural paradigm for the way that we think about the world being organised increasingly. So for me, that artist perhaps not having particularly interesting responses to these issues, I naturally look to the pilot fare and these kinds of, you know, the kinds of activities going on that use these same kinds of systems, but using them in very different ways. Using them in ways which undercut some of the working premises of the way that state power works and property works, still in very old-fashioned archaic ways, and really undercut it in quite radical ways. This is only a temporary moment. Soon, you know, even I'm feeling within the head doing some of the peer networks, so it won't be long until that's no longer an interesting area to look to.
But are you suggesting that I was struck, like, if you read somebody like Foucault or Derrida writing in the 80s, for example, or the 70s, and it's before all those kind of cultural developments, and you can kind of read them, you read them retrospectively in the light of those, and they seem to be talking about them. Yeah. Are you saying that these are the places where big social changes are happening?
I suppose in terms of the way cultural theories have been talking, people started to argue that the sort of issue around biopower is really central. I mean, that seems to resonate in the archive and database through this proliferation of DNA, collecting DNA information. You know, life itself has become archived in a really scary way.
So the human genome project, I've written about this in my comment, it's called commoditized sliced into slices. It's like the
visible human project,
which I think is probably redundant, but I'm not sure if it's still usable, but that's a kind of, for me, it's a massive example of state violence in a way. They take the body of a man criminal of somebody who's been executed in the state of Texas.
I've never heard of this.
A man and a woman were, they've got a male and a female body. And it's a massive project, and I mean, physically sliced as well as using the tomography. I don't remember the name of the type of the technique you use. But basically, to picture the human body from the feet to the top of the head in slices, that is, you can see the body at every slice. And of course, it's presented, you can access it, or you could access it on the internet. It was a database of human bodies, a visual database. But it wasn't the human body, it was a particular human body. It was a particular human body of somebody who had been executed.
Well,
a criminal, you know. And there's this issue in... there's
this
issue
about volunteers.
Was it like that Van Von Harden guy?
Yeah. There's a big controversy around him using Chinese, people who've been executed by China. But, you know, it's just that point, really, that these... That's just an extreme example of how the state power is still, or it's just an example of what you're saying, the relationship to the state power.
But arguably, it's articulated differently. It's articulated through security at the moment, it seems. Again, archive. So it's important in relation to these issues of security.
I think what you say about the databases is terrifying. I mean, is that joke? Computer says no, but actually it's not that funny, because so many systems and so many structures that are being imposed on us by the computer database culture and everything that we petitioned in, but it's affecting our everyday lives. It becomes a lot more rigid in the systems and structures around us, because the computer can't compute it, and it's all those systems are becoming really rigid. The words, you know, can't be quite right, and it can be flexible, it can be on the computer, and it has to be on the database. Without thinking, you just enter into this world of computerization. Some of the implications are, but hasn't he obviously lived with us in something or other, and the database is just the modern format of a sort of ledger. So, the way of processing. You know, obviously, we're more extensively
collecting, you know, for example, biodata. Obviously, you didn't have the.
I think the computer just enables you to process more information and access that information quickly.
But then.
But it doesn't, though, does it all work? I mean, that's the thing.
That's the great one. But
then you get the other thing aside of that, which we're talking about, is also all the more informal self archiving practices of people using things like effectively open source things that you could, if you wanted to, argue are all just part of the container. In a continuum, you know, you could take a kind of hardware and put it in, and it's all about control and so on. But you could, or you could see it in another way as a kind of playful freeing up of our kind of possibilities, and not necessarily as a negative.
Was it actual police versus culture?
Yeah, I mean, it's whether you see it all as all part of the police thing, or whether you see it as a proliferation of archives that may be going like that. That have become quite diverse, even though they might use under the same underlying data structure.
I suppose it's which one's more dominant, which of those comparatives is
more dominant.
Enable.